You're listening to the Sportsman's Nation, brought to you by Go Wild. Go Wild is one of the fastest growing social media applications for your mobile device. It's an app, right? And similar to Facebook or Instagram, it is a place for outdoor enthusiasts to meet and share their passion for the outdoors. So for more information, go to the Google Play Store or wherever you download your apps and download the Go Wild app. Or you can visit timetogowild.com for more information. Let's get outside. It's time to go wild.
Hey guys, welcome to another Land and Legacy Habitat Heroes podcast. And we are very excited to bring you guys this podcast.
We're live and on site, honestly.
Yeah, and we're here. And it's a podcast that has lots of topics.
Yes.
What we have for you is some landowners from different parts of the world talking about what gets them outside and what they enjoy about it. Podcast listeners. And so we talk a lot about different things that they enjoy about the hunting and what got them into it. We also have step-by-step process of planting native...
restoring prairies.
Grasses. Yeah. So if you're a guy looking for information on, okay, what do I do? How do I even get there? It's a long process, a lot longer than a food plot. It's really a year process, but once you get it established, this is a lifetime of enjoyment.
It's not nearly as overwhelming as you might think it is. Promise you it's not. And we also interview a guy who likes killing vegetation more than he likes killing deer. And he's a habitat land manager, prairie restoration guru, Mr. John Wingo himself from Pure Air Native. So extremely knowledgeable, lots of great points, lots of great perspectives here in this podcast as we're recording in Nashville, Tennessee, at the National Wild Turkey Federation. This is the After Hours Partay with Land and Legacy here at the convention. Hope you guys enjoy it.
So we're sitting here. This is our After Hours event with Pure Air Natives, Land and Legacy. We've covered topics tonight. We've talked a lot about native vegetation, habitat restoration, specifically with the native grasses and wildflowers. We've got multiple people here, but we've got a couple of guys here from when you look at where you guys live, you were a long ways apart.
Long ways.
So go ahead and
very long ways.
We'll start with you, sure. Adams. Introduce yourself, sure. What you do, and then where you're at.
Sure. Thanks. Well, my name is Adam Winkleman, and I'm from central Minnesota. So up by the St. Cloud area, about an hour and a half north of the cities. I got a new company, just started a new company called Relevant that got some solutions for optical surfaces, eyeglasses, and binoculars and such that reflect a lot of ultraviolet light, which turkey can see. We can resist that from happening and kind of complete that concealment. So we're new. This is my first show. Honestly, kind of new to turkey hunting in general. Only been out probably 3-4 times in my life and wanted to get out here and see what this organization's about. And it's pretty interesting, pretty good.
Yeah. Have you ever been to any other shows? I'm sure you have other, like, sure. Trade shows, expos. Yeah. How does this one compare?
I've been to a lot of shows, all on the optical side, obviously.
Yeah.
I've spent 20 years in optics and in the optical industry. I would say that this is about as organized and exciting as any of them that are out there. It's really interesting. I think that NWTF does a great job of combining the grassroots piece of this, right?
Right.
You know, if you go down to the chapters, as I'm learning this, they're all volunteer run, they're all volunteer based. And so when you do things on a volunteer level, you're in, you're committed, you're emotionally attached to what, you know, the subject or the organization might be. But it's not just that, it doesn't end there. It actually builds up into a real professionally organized, you know, entity that's got districts and regions, and it all just kind of flows up. And so I think they hit the nail on the head by being able to attach emotion with, you know, organization. And so unlike some of the other ones where it's basically an organization like the Vision Council, which is an amazing organization, and they tie in with like Reed, and it's really just drilled down, and then, you know, you have independent people that are trying to build their businesses or whatever. So I love it. I've been really excited about it. And 58,000, I think, people they figure.
That's what they estimate.
It's crazy.
It's insane. Today
was
3 days.
Unbelievable, trying to walk through the aisles. And
yeah.
We stayed in the booth most of the day because of so many people walking. But it's definitely a fun place. There's a wide variety. You've got landowners all the way down to the guys that hunt public ground.
Yep.
One thing really in common at this show is we all like turkeys or have some sort of.
Well, he thinks they're pests.
Yeah.
They're invasive. He said where it. I'm at, man. I love it. We're gonna get after him this year.
You're that's right. I can't believe you're saying that around here. People will be banging on your hotel room tonight trying to get permission to come
with. Said St. Cloud area, right?
That's it. I'd give him permission, man. I love it. I love people coming out. We'll go hunt turkeys. Whitetail now. That's limited to the very few. And we got some fun whitetail stuff too, but the turkeys, you know.
Unreal.
Let me know.
Yeah.
So
well it probably doesn't green up out there till what? July 4th.
Sometimes, man, days like we've been having, I don't know if it's ever going to get above zero again, but
oh man,
now green up happens in May or so.
Yeah.
You know. When is turkey season for you?
Third Wednesday of April.
Okay.
Yeah, it was when it opens.
So it's about the same time as ours.
Yeah, it really is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it'll last for
different
whatever, 4 weeks.
Weather conditions, most likely. Although last year we had snow on opening day, so it probably was a lot like a Minnesota opener.
And about 20 mile an hour winds.
Yeah, it was terrible.
Yeah.
Terrible.
Yeah.
So anyway, I know we're going to got some more questions for you, but let's go ahead and let Patrick here introduce himself.
Okay, I'm Patrick Stewart. I live in Marietta, Georgia, actually Kennesaw, Georgia. Firefighter for Marietta, City of Marietta. I've been there 17 years.
Wow.
And,
wow.
So enjoy my career, but have a small farm in south central Kentucky, and so I'm a non-resident landowner, and just always looking to improve the farm and see what I can do better for the wildlife.
Wow. I guess you told me that today. I hadn't even thought about it. But I appreciate you being a firefighter and all the other firefighters out there that listen. And
thank you.
So where you're firefighting, what is that? Mostly structure fires, I'm guessing. I have one cousin who's a new firefighter, but I'm not around a lot of firefighters. So I'm curious what's that like for you, 17 years into it?
Several structure fires. We do a whole lot of EMS now.
Okay.
As first responders, so that's definitely the majority of the calls that we run.
Yeah.
But after that, it's spread out from fires, auto accidents.
Gotcha.
Pretty much, if people don't know who to call, they call the fire department. So we're jack of
you
all trades
it.
And master of none, and we go see if we can help.
Very cool. Now you live in Georgia.
Yep.
But you own land hunt in Kentucky, correct?
Correct.
Correct. Okay.
What drew you to that part of Kentucky? Was it land price or family or just, I just want to be in the bluegrass state?
No, I was going to Illinois for a few years and on some paid hunts, and it's a very long drive.
Yeah.
And, you know, driving through Kentucky, the scenery looked somewhat the same. And it just, you know, it just looked like a great place to hunt.
Right.
So looking to not drive 12 and 13 hours, started looking around. Kentucky's a state that has come on here recently with, you know, producing a lot of good whitetail. And so leased some land for a couple of years and just really enjoyed it, and then started looking for something to buy.
Yeah, and they've got the really early season opportunity. I think it's like September 5th or so it opens up.
That's first Saturday in September.
Yeah. That's a velvet chance. Have you ever had or gone after a velvet deer so far?
I have not. I've only owned my property a couple of years.
Right.
And I guess I'm a little selfish with my time. I want to hunt when it gets cooler.
Sure. No. Yeah.
So
I've hunted Kentucky on that first opener, and it was fun because you get to chase deer in early September. But at the same time, you got to pack multiple thermocells with you because it's terrible.
You know, I actually found that the last 2 years I've been planting food plots. You
during
know,
that week.
During that week because, you know, I want to wait and save my time for hunting when the weather's a little different.
Yeah. Right.
Gotcha. So is this your first experience at National Wild Turkey Federation National Convention?
This is my fourth or fifth.
Okay.
Came several years, 5-6 years ago we came a few times, and then the last 2 years I've been able to bring my two boys, my wife, and they enjoy it. It's a madhouse, but
it is.
Yeah, they were out there. My two boys, each of them wanted to buy a mouth call today, so we joined in all the noise making. And, so It was interesting.
Yeah, I think actually when your boys came by the booth, they were practicing.
Yes.
Yep.
Did not sound like turkeys, but
I tried to teach your youngest the trick of hiss like a cat. That's like the very basic. Like once you can figure out how to hiss like a cat, then you can start making those noises a little bit closer to a turkey, and then just break it up into the rhythm of a turkey. And there you go. You're calling them.
Yeah, you were teaching them much better than I was. Walking with them through the aisles, I think I told them to put it up several times.
Oh, that's funny.
I do remember last year in turkey season, you were talking about opener, and it snowed.
Yeah.
That was the youth season for Kentucky.
Okay.
And it was cold.
Yeah.
So I think it was the Sunday morning. Had both my boys out, and it was like in the 20s. And three gobblers gobbling within about 300 yards, and both of them looked at me and said, "We're cold. We're ready to go.
Time to go in."
I'm like, "You're kidding, right?" So, no. But, yeah, that cold weather was tough on the kids last year.
It certainly was. It was tough on us. I'm not going to lie. It was cold that opening morning.
And we've talked a lot about our childhood. Like, we had terrible boots, terrible clothes, froze. Oh, my gosh, so cold. And so it sounds like you introduced them the same way my dad introduced me. Hey, I don't care. You're cold, but we're here, so that's enjoy it. Yeah. Oh, man. So, you guys both listen to the podcast. What is it about land that is kind of the addiction? What is it for you? What draws you out there?
I mean, for me, it's just so peaceful. I just love the whole thing. There's a number of different reasons why I enjoy our land. We were really blessed to have a couple hundred acres that we're able to manage and work, and there was work to be done with it. And I think that's part of what I really enjoy is actually, I love growth. I'm an entrepreneur by sort of spirit. I've had a business and sold that, and the company that I worked for, you know, we built another business inside of that, and now I'm doing this again. And I have this addiction to, like, seeing things grow and build. And I don't understand it because it's like getting your butt kicked every day. And so I don't know, I guess I like abuse. But the same is true with the land. You know, I just really, 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 really like looking at the map and just agonizing over it and thinking about how could I make this better? And well, that was stupid. I shouldn't have never done that. Now, how do I fix that when, you know, you got established stuff and I was able to put it into CRP and a cost sharing program and stuff. And so some of it I can't. Some of it is what it is. You got to live with those mistakes, and we'll try to go through it. So I just really, I like that part of it. And then I don't think there's any other feeling unless you do it for me than just sitting in a tree. It sounds ridiculous. I mean, I'm a 30 out of 30 extrovert. I mean, I'm over on the scale that doesn't hardly exist. And yet when I sit in a tree, it's just like, it's peaceful, you know? And then you get to, you know, be with wildlife, and they don't even know you're on the planet, and they're walking underneath your stand, or you're calling them, and they're responding. It's just that ability to be able to do that, an opportunity to be able to do that, for me, is wonderful. Now, if I get my wife to have that same enjoyment, wow, then watch out. But maybe I don't want that.
May not be as
Be careful what I wish for. But for me, those are the things, Adam. I think, you know, it's that growth and ability to be able to, you know, try to make the habitat better and then just enjoy it.
You kind of almost have a place. Like, once you do the work, you feel like you fit into it. And it's not just tromping through the woods trying to kick something up.
Yeah.
It's like you have a place. You fit into the system.
Yeah. No, I think that's exactly right. For me, that's what I like.
Yeah.
Yeah. For me, it's my getaway.
Yeah.
Whether I'm out working on the farm or hunting, it doesn't matter. That's when the rest of the world and all the troubles and cares can kind of be put to the side and forgotten about it. And I really enjoy that time because life is so busy. Mm-hmm. But growing up, just always loved the outdoors. Got my bachelor's degree in natural resource management and never used it. So now that I do own a farm, it's just nice to get to use that little bit of knowledge and start to implement some things that I've always wanted to do. Growing up in the South, I'm part of that traditional hunting club culture. So, you know, you were at the landowner's mercy where you leased the land and that's what you got. You really couldn't do anything. Mm-hmm. And so now that I'm, you know, having that opportunity to do something else, just trying to make it my property as good as it can be for the experience when we're there hunting, but also just to enjoy, like with you guys' podcast, to try to make it what it's actually supposed to be. And I can see that if I can make it what it's supposed to be, then the hunting aspect, it's going to be there.
It's a benefit down the road.
Sure.
It's going to come. It's going to happen.
Sure.
For sure. And you get to work the land day in and day out the whole time.
So we've got a couple. We got other guests, but I know you guys got any questions. You had something you want to cover here on this podcast, too.
Sure, sure. You know, for me, I have a question that I've been trying to get, and it's been a bit of a struggle trying to really get answers out there on the web. So I figured, you know.
That's dangerous.
That's where all the truths are.
That's where the truth is, yeah. Well, and I'm sure inside there is a lot of the truth, right? But I'm having a hard time discerning the difference between what it is. And,
right.
And openly, I'm not a farmer. I'm not new. I'm kind of like you, you know. I wanted to be a DNR, actually. That was what my whole plan was, to go to Bemidji and go to school there or whatever. And then I met with the counselor, and they told me the classes I needed to take. And well, I just wasn't ready for that. So I've always tell people that I was never smart enough for college, and I was too much of a coward for the military. So I just joined sales. I went into sales, I've been kind of studying all this stuff and trying to learn it and whatever and trying to figure it out. But we have a huge issue on our property. My uncle and I have adjoining properties, and it's with water hemp. And we are really, really struggling with trying to figure out what's the solution to this. I understand how we can probably beat it up over time, and that's great and that's good, you know, with different techniques and stuff, but I want to pound it now. Mm-hmm. And while I do that, build out a plan for, you know, a sustainable solution, because everything we've tried is failing, and it is big and it's mm-hmm. a lot and
yeah.
it's invasive. And so any suggestions you have on that?
That's a topic that we discussed here at our event tonight was, you know, when you look at water hemp, it's one of the many species we have that's built up this resistance
yeah.
to glyphosate. So
right.
a lot of our Roundup Ready soybeans, you're starting to see these invasives that just come back, and it's almost like the spray, or it is the spray, just has no effect. And
yeah.
we talked about changing that over out of a glyphosate tolerant bean or a Roundup Ready bean to a more different bean. Use a different herbicide, a Liberty Link. Or, and you talked about using dicamba.
Sure.
We've seen where areas of the country that have had horrible water hemp switch over to Liberty Link, knock it out completely. But another step with that, and it also helps the land, is including cover crops with that.
Right.
So you
okay.
start getting this breakdown of
sure.
of cover crops to kind of serve as a weed mat the next spring as you come back to plant the beans.
Yeah.
And doing that, you start weeding it out to where there's not nearly as much water hemp.
Yeah.
You're killing it with that. And then at the same time, though, you don't want that water hemp to build up the resistance to the Liberty Link.
Yeah.
And so you create this rotation not only with cover crops, but a rotation with different herbicides to where it's not year after year after year of Liberty Link until it's built up that resistance. You include other herbicides to knock it out. Matt, you got anything to add on that?
I'll say, just coming back in, don't, you know, think, you know, from a farming aspect, just a herbicide is a solution. Come back with that cover crop. There's a
okay.
lot of science behind suppressing weeds through cover crops.
Competition and stuff.
Competition, protecting that ground, the soil, and keeping it covered through spring greenup.
When you think about nature and the way it works, bare ground isn't natural. It's
mm-hmm.
not something that's supposed to happen. Mm-hmm. When it does happen, though, nature tries to cover it up as quickly as possible.
Sure.
And so when it is exposed, it tries to cover it with whatever is going to grow. And so every time you diss the field, you've got bare ground, which it doesn't want. And so then you plant your beans, but you have spacing in between the beans,
yep.
and it's trying to get something to cover it up. And
yep.
and it ends up being something that's tolerant
you make
of the herbicide.
Perfect for weeds.
Sure.
Yeah.
But you're trying to grow a commodity crop. So you make this perfect place, you know, this environment for weeds, and then you don't want them. So let's not make it perfect for weeds. Let's bring in the cover crop and then plant, let the commodity come through, and then you can spray out the cover crop.
I don't know how much time you want to spend on it, but, like, do you see, like, what's the sequence of it? I mean, is there a pre-emerge process to, you know, where does that whole sequence fall into play, or do you just hit it?
Let's just jump in January 1, and last fall you planted your cover crop. So January 1, you've got
you've got wheat and turnips or whatever, whatever's consistent
snow.
Of the...
Snow. I have snow.
You have
January
snow.
January 1, I have
you
snow.
You have snow. And underneath that snow, you have cover crop.
Okay, yes, okay,
going, great. Oh my gosh, I can't wait till spring.
That's right. It's herbicide, it's a de-icer.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Pre-emergent is de-icer, it's salt. And so then you fast forward and you get through the melting of the snow and you get into the more warmer temperatures. You see that cover crop start growing. You start seeing it really expand and flourish. And then it gets about time for planting season and you terminate that cover crop. And it basically, as it's terminated, it starts to fall down and lay flat on the ground. At the same time, you've probably come in and planted your crop. Mm-hmm. And so you have this cover crop now laying on the ground. You drill right through it and planted your beans. And that's just the cover crop is now your native, your natural weed barrier.
Weed barrier.
And protecting, putting armor on that soil to where there's not exposed soil causing weeds to want to grow.
You don't have that beneficial weed environment at that point anymore.
Right.
And so you've got months of that decaying and decaying and decaying. And at that point, you've got the beans growing up to now, hopefully they've canopied out.
Sure.
So there's shade on the ground. So there's no need for something to germinate and try to protect that soil.
That's good.
Then you go into the fall and you've harvested the beans and you plant your next cover crop. Yeah.
Or let
keep
the deer
something.
Beans.
Or do that. But just keeping something, an active root system in that ground the whole time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's good.
That you want.
So.
Right.
Between cover crops, commodity crops.
And so like in your area, part of the world, it's cereal rye is a hugely popular cover crop. And so that's one of the big ones where it doesn't take a lot to grow. It can grow in a little bit colder temperatures, but it's still in the spring, it grows 5-6 foot tall and then you lay it
very
over.
Quickly.
And you terminate that and then you just build into or plant into it again.
That's right.
Yep. Got it.
So. Good. Hopefully that helps.
Spray and
it
smother.
Did, yeah, that helps a lot. What's that? Yeah.
Spray and smother.
Yeah.
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 You got anything, Patrick?
Yeah, I got a question. As a non-resident landowner, you know, there's a lot of things that we cannot do that a resident could do, especially, save my farm, for instance. Like, I want to get some type of income off of the open ground.
Yes.
And my land is rolling. I've had several farmers look at it. It's just not conducive to row crops.
Yeah.
And it was an old cattle farm. Like I said, I can't be there. Don't really want cattle on my property all year. So hay is a consideration.
Yeah.
I know what we think about Bermuda, or not Bermuda, but fescue hay. But outside of that, what would be your suggestions maybe if you were looking to have some income off of a hay crop?
So when it comes to hay, one of the things we always usually recommend is try to lean more towards alfalfa hay, or at least alfalfa heavily involved in some sort of
fescue.
Diversity. Yeah,
right.
Fescue is the last thing we want.
You can add in red clover, white clover, alfalfa.
Even if it's orchard grass with lots of alfalfa and red clover involved is better. But an alfalfa crop is kind of the goal with that. Or there's other options to make money. We just recently were finding out about agroforestry, where people are planting trees to kind of to make an income off of. But for you, if you're in an ag kind of area where there's hay involved, I would say lean towards something like alfalfa or orchard grass and clover mix, or hopefully a straight. You see a lot of guys just planting straight alfalfa. As much as we hate monocultures, that's kind of the popular one that you can make some nice money off of.
Sure.
And from a forage standpoint, it's extremely attractive. Turkeys, deer, early season, it's going to be incredible over alfalfa fields.
Okay. Very good.
Yeah. Well, we're glad you guys joined us tonight.
Thanks for having us.
And I know we talked about, Matt and I were just as much, it was more of a conversation than a seminar, because we had so many great things in the room
and knowledgeable
with the guys
people with Pure Air.
Air here. So I know I'm excited to get them back on or get them on here, and we can talk some of the actual steps, nitty gritty of planting native. So appreciate you guys.
Thanks for having us.
You bet.
All right. Next up, we have some employees of Pure Air Natives who haven't been on the podcast before.
Pure Air,
big fan of Sawtooth Oaks. A little bit of an inside joke for people. We were at the show. We're still here at the National Wild Turkey Federation convention, and we saw a handout of Sawtooth Oaks
and Chinese chestnuts.
And Chinese chestnuts, yes. From a place that should know better. We'll just say
anonymous
that.
Anonymous location.
That should know better.
People. Yeah.
Yeah. And so you guys, big into native grasses and wildflower restoration projects.
John, you want to introduce yourself? How long you been here? What's your role at Pure Air?
At Pure Air, I am more of a consultant.
Okay.
I work more on the DJM, the installation, the contracting side of the business. Like I said, Pure Air, I'm more on the actual field identification, going out with clients, doing some installation type work. That's
your role.
That's my role.
Do you go by Jonathan or John?
John. Typically. Depends on.
But that name's already taken, so you have to go with Jonathan.
Yep. Depends on who I'm standing next to.
And if they're mad at you or not.
Yeah.
Jonathan.
Yeah. So, Nick?
Yep. I've been with DJM for about 3 years now. I'm a foreman, like he said. Do the contracting side for Pure Air, you know, installing the prairies, the TSI work, erosion control and stuff like that, and concentrating on the habitat, making sure that it is the way it needs to be for our clients, not only private, but for the conservation, for the Corps engineers, do a lot of work for the government agencies like that. So
between the two of you guys and DJM and everything, what are some of the typical projects that you guys have going on, or your, you know, most popular types of projects that you work on throughout a given year?
It does vary a little bit by time of year. So this time of year, we're working a lot in timber stands, removing invasives like honeysuckle, autumn olive, tree of heaven is big around us in the city.
You guys, I think all invasives are big around you guys in the city. Yeah. Every time we drive through St. Louis, it's just like shut your eyes, because it's nothing but bush honeysuckle and
except
tree
for the
of
one
heaven.
Driving.
Except for the one driving, and then you just try to tunnel vision it because you don't want to look around.
It is pretty terrible, especially our roadways.
Yeah.
You know, I feel bad for anyone that's driving through our state that actually knows what they're looking at. And there's, you know, we understand there's limited funds to take care of that, but if we could, we'd do it.
Oh, yeah.
It's hard to watch.
It is very hard to watch. It's so frustrating, and it's sickening. Oh, man. And roadways, I mean, you drive I-70 from St. Louis, Kansas City. There's some beautiful prairies right there in the median, and with all kinds of encroachment of non-natives and other invasives, and it's happening right in front of our very eyes.
Yeah.
But just not many of us know what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
Is that, what would you say? What does a majority of your year look like?
Well.
That varies. We haven't got one straight answer out of these guys.
No. With working for DJM, that's the hardest question I've ever been asked.
That's a true statement.
What do I do? Huh? It's an ecological service, yeah. We do, like I said, we focus on the prairie restoration, the ecological type work. But, I mean, we go from green roofs, working for BJC Hospital down in St. Louis, from green roofs. We go from, like I said, working in the prairies, prescribed burns. Timber stand improvement, working for MSD to building rain gardens. It varies so much, which is kind of a great quality to have, because you're not getting bored. You know, kind of doing
every
something.
Project brings something new to the
exactly,
table.
Exactly. You know, and you're not seeing the same thing every day, like if you were a carpenter or something like that. So it's kind of cool. But I'd say the things that I look forward to working for DJM is the prescribed burns. Everyone likes fire.
Mm-hmm.
It's cool, and especially in the spring, we all love deer sheds. So, I mean, it's a pretty easy way to find those. And then the TSI, the timber stand improvements, and then, you know, those are a lot of fun doing that. That's kind of what I look forward to.
That was going to be my next question, is what is your favorite part? What is the one part of your job that you look forward to the most? But since you answered, I'll ask John.
Yep.
Okay, and my favorite part is seeing the transformation process.
Start to finish,
and sometimes it's an instant thing. Like if you're in a timber stand, and you know, over the process of a week, you can turn around, and that look completely different than it did a week before. I oftentimes have to take photos because when you're doing the work, you don't necessarily realize what you're doing.
Sure.
But when you go back and look at that photo, you can say, "Wow, that instantly changed. I made a difference."
Right. You were showing me something the other day about a site. I think it was down in the Mississippi, kind of the Delta bottom area. And you guys had came in and removed I think it was bush honeysuckle.
Yes.
And talk about, you know, that process, you know, the bush honeysuckle removal, and then what came back within a year.
Okay, that was a large commercial site, mm-hmm. For a Fortune 500 company, mm-hmm. of ours, and they had hired us to remove invasives and thin the canopy a little bit. They were looking more of an aesthetic look, mm-hmm. so we did remove a lot of the material that was on the ground also, sure. which yep. normally in a habitat setting we wouldn't do.
Yeah.
But in the process of removing all that material, we opened that forest floor so much that natives that may have been dormant for 10, 15, 20 years had instantly came back the next spring, and it made for some awesome pictures. In that particular case, there was just rows of Virginia bluebells that came back.
Mm. In full bloom.
Which is hard. Gorgeous. I mean, it's not everywhere. You know, you don't see that mm-hmm. particular species everywhere. So it was really neat to see it come back the way it should be.
Right. And without removing the invasives, without the additional sunlight, that wouldn't have happened. You wouldn't have come back that next year and seen that.
No. No one probably even knew it was there, you know.
Right, right. I think that brings, you know, the important factor of what we talk about all the time is, you know, doing this work, you kind of have an understanding of, you know, a goal of where you want to get to, but you never know what that seedbed has got in mm-hmm. store and exposing it. You can be pleasantly surprised, and it's kind of a treasure box.
It is.
And you're opening up a package on Christmas morning. You don't know if it's going to be a beautiful wildflower or a native grass or whatever it's going to be. Sometimes, and this is the question we get a lot, well, if I open it up, all I'm going to get back is an invasive.
Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah, but if you don't open it up, it's always going to be the same, if not declining. Well, it will be declining. It's mm-hmm. just going to get worse and worse. So if it is an invasive that comes up, we'll come back and get rid of it too, and then we'll see what we have coming back.
Yeah.
So sitting on our hands is not the way to do it.
No. And on that particular site, erosion was also a very big issue.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure you guys have talked about it before, about the fact that honeysuckle does not provide any erosion control at all.
No, very little leaf cover underneath them.
Yeah, and the fact that we were able to get a native establishment that very next spring is already going to start improving that process.
And the root system on bush honeysuckle is terrible.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of those that, even if almost a 5-foot tree, you grab it and yank it out of the ground. It's terrible. So that's awesome. Virginia bluebells.
Mm-hmm.
What's been the rarest of rare that you've found?
That's a tough question.
Because that's always the most exciting thing for me is you do this work or you see all these acres and acres and acres, and you find that one flower, you're like, I do not know what that is.
Yeah,
and you have to go look it up.
Surprising. Have you ever cried over a flower? Don't answer that. No, just don't do it.
Oh, I'd have to think about that. And I'm not as good as we have one employee that does all the actual putting the mixes together and all the background work behind mm-hmm. everything at Pure mm-hmm. Air. And he's like an encyclopedia, we call him. When we have a question about a plant, we call him.
What's his name? I think I've met him.
Trevor.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. So I defer a lot of questions to Trevor when I don't know things, because there's some plants.
It's hard to keep up with.
It is. Oof. I mean, there are
thousands
of species.
Thousands.
In every individual state, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And he knows every single one of them.
That's incredible.
But he does.
Yeah. So that's a really hard question to answer because I defer a lot of those unknowns to him.
Right.
I know for us, one of the most exciting ones, there's been two in the last year, and I'll credit my brother with one of them, with both of them actually, because he's the one who found them and told me about them. Matt and I, we went back and found them, but we had this small, and it didn't register as glade, and I say that with air quotes because it didn't register in the state agency site index mapping software, but everything points to it being a glade. It's rock outcroppings, a mm-hmm. Lot of glade-sensitive species, and then there was cedar encroachment. And so we actually did a government program, and we removed the cedars. Drastic amounts of sunlight came down, and went back and here's this plant growing around, and we're looking at it and we're like, that's the craziest. That's a weird looking plant. It ended up looked like a milkweed, but it was a vine. And we narrowed it down to where we believe is Baldwin's milk vine, which hasn't been registered in USDA for that county, Douglas County, Missouri. So we're still unsure, but we believe it's probably that. And then after a timber harvest, closed canopy forest timber harvest, all kinds of sunlight, and we saw one of our native honeysuckles come up, and we hadn't seen in the area ever, so really cool for us.
Now, you guys are super big hunters. We've been talking about hunting, you know, in the booth the whole weekend. You have some opportunities, probably through the job and everything, to be able to hunt prairies. Mm-hmm. Not that many people hunt prairies, especially from a whitetail standpoint. Tell me a good hunt over a prairie, because we know, and we're always talking about, you know, how the system's so beneficial and this and that. Like, what is it truly, from a hunting standpoint, like hunting that prairie? You know, and quality of deer we're talking about, because you guys have shown some pictures, and it's pretty awesome.
Well, with deer hunting, it's what I tell my friends and people that are clients that I talk to. When you think of a prairie, it's more of a bedding. Mm-hmm. So I try to stay out of the prairies mm-hmm. when I'm hunting, just because that's their sanctuary. That's where they want to be. They'll come out when they want to eat, when they want to roam. But me personally, I stay out of prairies. Now, walking through prairies, I've never seen so much deer activity. You know, the bedding, the trails. I mean, it's like New York City running through there. There's trails going everywhere. I'm like any of the tall, the blue stem, the Indian grass, anything like that, and the switchgrass at my farm, it's unreal the deer activity that's in there. Like I said, I try to stay away from it just because that's their sanctuary.
Right.
But it's unreal how the activity that runs through.
I'm sure you've probably seen it, but when you use prescribed fire and you come back and you're looking for sheds, you can see the trails.
Oh yeah, they're green. They're already green because there's nothing.
It's matted down.
Yeah.
You, John, okay. Jonathan.
Yeah, and
your dad's in the room. So,
like you said, it's when I talk to people about it, it's a little different, because if someone asks me like a question about timber hunting, I'm like, I don't know. Like, I've never hunted hardwood timber. It's just a completely different thing to me. But I think I was telling you a story about hunting in northern Missouri, and it's literally like hunting out west if you get into hill ground that has, you know, large establishments of prairie, and you can spot and stalk deer. And I've had some really good results with that. And it's just neat to see the way they move through a prairie.
Right.
Yeah, I have had a lot of success hunting through prairies, and I think it's just because I feel like it's almost easier to pattern a deer in a prairie. You can see how they're moving from the bedding source, like he said, if it is the prairie, into the food source, which could also be part of that prairie. You know, maybe a different setting, a different height variation in that prairie. It's just, I'm a visual hunter, so it's easier to watch deer for me in a prairie than
absolutely
in a woodland setting where they're maybe just passing through or feeding on a couple acorns.
Very cool.
And you shared a hunt, basically, I guess it was rut, and buck chases doe, you cut them off, you know, you spotted them, made a plan, cut them off, and it's the biggest buck you've killed, right?
Yeah, and that buck scored 164. You know, to some people that's a huge deer. To some people that's, you know, a good deer. But for that type of hunting in Missouri, you know,
that's a great deer. No matter what. Yeah. That's awesome. I think there needs to be more stories told about, you know, the prairies and the wildlife, the hunting in and around them, because not many people have the opportunity to, and we're trying to get more out there, trying to get more from, because response from hunters and land managers, you know, and it boils down to success around them. We talked about turkeys this afternoon. I'm sure the rabbits and everything else is incredible. Quail.
Yeah.
as well in and around those prairies.
Yep.
Yeah. Well, thank you guys for joining us.
Yeah.
And keeping it fun in the booth all weekend.
Yeah.
It's been a fun show. I know we have a couple more guests put on here, so thank you guys.
You're welcome.
So now we have the real deal, John Wingo. Not the one prior, but the real John Wingo, correct?
John Wingo can be in two places at once.
And then we have Justin joining us once again. Pure Air Natives guys, been around, combining. John, you've been in Natives for a long, long time. Before we started recording, you were telling that you kind of started getting into the Native situation in, what, mid-80s, basically? So 30-plus years you've been...
87's when I really turned from traditional horticulture to Natives.
Well, that's easy math for me. That was the year I was born. So 31 years you've been doing Natives. Justin, you've been at Pure Air for two years?
Yeah, 14, 15 months or so.
Okay. Yeah.
Second NWTF show here. So.
Yeah. So kind of a, you know, everybody's already touched on it, but a great show. Always a lot of fun. A lot of people coming through here. 58,000, I think, is what they're saying. So big show, big crowd.
Diverse crowd, too.
Diverse.
Young, old.
Speaking of diverse.
Yeah.
Way to throw that in there, man.
Who would have known?
Yeah, the segue right there. the old transition right into diversity. And, John, you've been, as I said, 31 years doing this. So I ask you this in the show. Have you seen, what is the changes you've seen in the amount of information people are seeking, information that people are gaining from diverse Native stands? Where does that rank as far as 30 years ago, 15 years ago to now? Do you feel like there's more people excited and looking back into Native prairie type restoration or less?
Oh, definitely more. When I first started out, I was just some nut planting weeds.
Yeah. I figured so.
And, anymore, it's in vogue now. It's speaking engagements, and people really want to hear about it.
Yeah, and not I think we've talked about it tonight, but not just people that are – you pull from all crowds. You've got people wanting more pollinators. So they're looking at this. You've got cattle farmers wanting a better summer forage. So they're looking at native grasses and native plantings. And then you've got people concerned just environment and trying to improve the environment, water and air quality. And so they're looking at this. Seems like there's so many people going this route, man. And it's got to be exciting for you. I'm sure back in 31 years ago and everybody thought you were a nut planting weeds, it was kind of like, I know how I would be, where at some point you're like, man, am I just going to always look like a fool to these people, or are they going to get it at some point? So I'm sure it feels good to know more and more people are looking into it. So
that it does. It, it was hard to take the first 10 years of abuse.
Yeah, I imagine so, for sure.
What do you think in that 31 years was the tipping point that you saw, okay, maybe it was one major thing, just change, you know, that people are like, I got it now. What was that? Or is that a thing? Just been a slow migration?
Have we even made it to that point?
Yeah.
Well, honestly, the past 10 years have been really the turning point, the pivot point of when people have started to realize that, you know, we're pulling nature back into balance, and it's having multiple benefits, not just looking at the flagship species like quail and turkey and the game species, but also looking at the other impacts like stormwater runoff, air quality, carbon sequestration. And honestly, we're not doing anything new. We're just putting back what was there before. It's kind of like we do all these bioswales now for stormwater runoff, but you know, the prairie streams and that, we're doing that thousands of years before we ever settled this country.
You think he's listening to the podcast, or is he just preaching the same thing we've always talked
drinking
about?
Drinking the same Kool-Aid.
We were drinking the same Kool-Aid. Oh, that's all. So it's probably very frustrating for you, too, when you're talking about the erosion control. People are doing this, and you see people put, like, turf grass in the waterways. Are you as frustrated with that as I am? We walk a lot of these waterways, and across the Midwest in crop fields in their tall fescue or orchard grass. And it's like, I thought we knew better, but apparently we don't.
Well, it's the same story. I mean, mm-hmm. basically, in this urban environment, we had gone through the phase where it was, you know, you piped everything in concrete, you hardened off your streams, and you got the water out of there as fast as possible. But water velocity is our enemy.
That's the issue.
Yeah.
And fescue is great for water velocity. If you want to make a waterway out of a tall fescue, why, it lays over and it sheets water mm-hmm. just like concrete.
Yeah.
And so the scenario is the same on both ends. You're moving water faster, but you're moving all your assets, your topsoil, your debris, your pollutants are all going down to the Gulf of Mexico quicker.
Yep. Yep. Oh.
I think it sounds like basically the research is what's out there now. About that, you know, 10 years ago, we really started to study it and figure out, oh, my gosh, what we had before is actually what we need now. And would you agree with that? You know, when the research really started to come out, people's eyes just opened up.
Well, pretty much. And it's the same way with prairie restoration. You know, everything prior to 10 years ago was all anecdotal. There's data now. People have opened their eyes now, paying attention. And just mm-hmm. analyzing the problems we have, we're actually reverse engineering things is what we're doing.
Yeah.
You know, we've got the problem. We're just now recognizing it.
Yeah. Wow. I know we definitely want to cover this, and before we forget it, or before we get on, because I've got multiple questions to ask. Sorry, Justin.
Hey.
You've been on here before. You're just going to be here to kind of help guide and keep him in line, right?
I don't know how much I'll be able to do that, but, yeah, I'm just here to hang out.
And so John's been doing this, and I'm sure he's got – I know we've hung out a couple times on – and specifically on a planting recently, and so he's got a lot of great stories. But let's walk through for our listeners the best scenario for planting and establishing native grasses and wildflowers. Let's say we're trying to restore a prairie, pollinator setup. What is step number one?
Open your eyes. Look and see what you have there already.
Yeah.
Because that initial site assessment and visualizing what natural plant community would have occurred there pre-settlement, or what is the topography and your climate and your soils going to direct you to. If you don't do a good initial site assessment and you're trying to put a tall grass prairie on a glade setting, mm-hmm. it's not going to end well.
Yes.
But if you do a good initial site assessment, followed up with, once you've established, you know, the community that's there, what are your problem children? You know, what invasive species are there? What sort of weeds are you expecting in that seed bank? Like, has it been an old pasture and it's gone to seed year after year with quite a bit of non-native species seeding into that soil? You're going to have built up a seed bank of those. And looking around at the adjacent properties and what's in the fence rows can kind of give you a good clue to what you're going to face after you kill off your fescue or whatever that predominant crop was there before. Preparing a good plan for dealing with that in advance and doing, you know, at least one full season of preparation to eliminate some of that seed bank in the soil. Because, like, if you've got a fescue pasture, the fescue is allelopathic, so it suppresses a lot of species from coming through it. And when you kill the fescue, you get that flush of whatever is in that seed bank below that. It's kind of like a bad Christmas. You know, you don't know what presents you're going to be brought, but it's going to be a surprise. Being prepared for that, then following through, doing a good job of eliminating your competition on the front end is step one. Step two, designing the appropriate plant community to go into that. And then the third step is following through with proper establishment stewardship. The amount of times that I've been fired in the second year for people thinking, well, this is just a weed patch that's come up, is phenomenal. I mean, it's almost every time. But by year three, if they've done what they've been told and done the proper stewardship, high mowed the annual weeds off so they don't go to seed, spot sprayed out any perennials before they can produce some large flush of seed and then reestablish themselves.
Yeah.
You know, third year it comes around.
Yeah. So what was that little thing you told us?
Sleep.
Oh, yeah. A prairie in its first year it sleeps. It puts down a root system. Second year it creeps. It doesn't grow very much. It's still fighting battle with the competition. Third year it leaps. So it finally starts to look like what people expected in that first year, because yeah. nobody's got the patience to wait 3 years.
it's tough. Yeah. It's tough sometimes, because what we deal with all the time when we're talking about food plots and this and that, that's pretty much immediate results. 2 weeks later, hopefully, you know, you're getting some sort of germination.
Instant gratification.
Yeah. You know, that's what we search for. It's just based on our culture these days. But, you know, we're going back into something, or, you know, looking at history. It takes time to get this stuff to develop, and we have to take our mindset out of instant gratification when we're planting something that is going to be established for so long if we do the right maintenance.
So let's say a landowner or a listener has a 5-acre field that's 1-acre food plot. The rest is just old pasture. It's just mostly tall fescue, whatever. It used to have cows on it years ago. Now it doesn't. It's a hunting farm. How can they establish diverse natives within that stand? What are the steps? Of course, we're going to assess and see what natives, what was their pre-settlement, what the best stand would be to establish. Correct?
Correct.
So then what would be the next step?
The next step is to eliminate existing cover.
So start, what time of the year would you recommend starting on
that? I would normally recommend starting May or June.
Okay.
And go ahead and spray that out.
With what?
Well, normally, you know, if it's in an area where we don't have a huge problem, like in a lot of agricultural settings with Roundup resistant, we would just use glyphosate.
And I'm really trying to put him in a box here and make him uncomfortable, because we're trying to get answers out of a lot of variables.
Yep.
And so we'll just try to humor me. How about that?
Yeah.
Humor me.
Well, looking at that old pasture, I'm going to expect to have to do an extensive cleanup.
Yeah.
Because it's not like row crop ground where a lot of that weed seed bank has been worked out of the soil and killed off over time.
Yeah.
So it's built up a fairly decent seed bank of cool season invasive and just normal run-of-the-mill annual weeds.
Yeah, so you're going to spray
So I'm going to spray it probably 3 times through that summer.
Yeah.
And then if it looks pretty clean, I will probably cover crop that in the fall, and then no-till drill or frost seed into it in the winter.
With your natives.
With my natives in the dormant season.
Yeah.
Because most of your natives are smarter than I am. They're not going to throw all their chips on the table at once. And to get the best bang for your buck, they need a lot of cold moist stratification, where they go through oscillating warming, cooling, and freezing and thawing, and get some moisture in there to break down that seed coat. But they, even with perfect stratification, they don't all germinate at once. There'll be some stragglers that'll prairie always hedges its bet, you know. It doesn't put all its cards on the table at once. So you know, I want to get as much of that to germinate as I can in that first year, but my expectation is I'm going to see things that second year I didn't see. And there are some species that won't express themselves for 5 to 6 years if you're going in with a diverse native mix.
Wow.
When you talk about cover crop, we've talked about this before the podcast, maxing out 30 pounds an acre for wheat, oats, because you don't want too dense of a stand of a cover crop so you can broadcast and have that, you know, seed to soil contact. Is that correct?
That's correct. I mean, you can get carried away real easily just wanting to see something green.
Sure.
But the factor with that is erosion. You know, if it's a steep slope, I may go up as high as a bushel to the acre on my steeper places. But, you know, where I've got flat ground and it's not going to wash, a good density is about a half bushel to the acre for a cover crop.
Gotcha. What about during that summer months, could a person, I'm sure there's benefit to like planting a Roundup Ready soybean in that area, so you have something growing where it's not just bare ground. Is that something you guys recommend or could do?
Oh yeah, most definitely.
Okay.
I mean, with the realization that you will be spraying it out in the fall.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay.
But you know, Roundup Ready beans is a good solution.
Yeah.
You know, if there's problems with any of your Roundup resistant crops in there, because there's been Roundup resistant mare's tail that's come out a lot now.
Yeah.
Roundup resistant water hemp. And worst come to worse, Palmer amaranth is. Yep. A real culprit you have to watch out for, because it produces a great proliferation of seed compared to your water hemps and your others. I mean, that's what puts a damper on the soybeans, is it gets enough in there that it really reduces yield.
And you may have to spray the whole thing with another herbicide and just kill it all.
Yeah. So you really want to watch out where you have wind-pollinated annual species in there, because they develop resistance quicker.
Okay, and so now we fast forward and you plant the natives in the winter.
Plant the natives in the dormant season.
Yes, sir.
And when you're in the dormant season, you're going to get more diversity as far as your forbs go. Your wildflowers will germinate before the grasses. And if your goal is grasses, I normally recommend that people bump up the quantity of grasses if they're doing a dormant season planting, because a lot of those will be suppressed in that seeding, planting in the dormant season. Follow that up with good stewardship throughout the first establishment year is really critical. I normally try to get at least one mow in before the summer solstice. But if I have a really warm spring, it may be as early as the end of May for your first mowing. And the reason for mowing is to clip that before any of your winter annuals go to seed, because the whole thing is to limit the population growth and just favor the natives, which are growing slow. So we're clipping those annuals off, and then we're being vigilant, watching our fence lines and things we expect to come in there as far as persistent perennial weeds like thistles, Sericea lespediza, Johnson grass, some of your plantains that are perennials that will persist and really won't be knocked back by just mowing. So combination of high mowing and spot spraying, and it's really not that much to it.
Is there going to be any mowing on? Yeah, not that much to it. It's a how many month process. But once you get established, let's say 2 years in, are you doing any mowing the second year?
The second year, it's really nice to at least get one high mow in there right around the summer solstice is ideal, because many of your warm season species haven't started the process of flowering.
Yeah.
And they'll still bloom that second year, but bloom shorter. They're dwarfed back, and you know, still monitoring is your most critical step, and knowing what you're looking for.
Opening your eyes again
and educating yourself on, you know, what weed pressures do you have out there, do you know what your planting should be looking like, do you recognize the seedlings and the early stages of growth in your prairie plants and know the difference between those and the weeds. So it takes a little research.
And so once it's established now, do you usually recommend what kind of maintenance over the long haul?
Over the long haul, if they are fire-dependent plant communities, so it's really good to get in there and burn those. In lieu of burning, if it's in a situation where a person's not comfortable with it, it can be mowed. If I have to mow in lieu of burning, I like dormant season burns to start out with, but if I can't burn, I'm going to just mow it down to dirt in February or March when everything's cured out good, and that plant material will just shatter and disperse into smaller pieces and not be smothering the existing prairie.
Let's say from a habitat standpoint, would you recommend mowing a portion of it every single year? Let's say you've got a 5-acre prairie and you know there's quail and rabbits in there, you know, mowing, let's say, an acre and a half 1 year, then coming back and doing the next, you know, on a rotation like that, so you're not removing all that cover at one point.
Yes, whether mowing or burning, we normally like to divide it up into units, and for sure not do over 50% a year. You know, when you're in that third, fourth, fifth, and continued on into establishment, not only for just nesting cover, but there's a lot of insects and invertebrates that, that overwinter.
Absolutely.
On plant stalks. Praying mantises will be up there on your a lot of your goldenrods and that, and there's a lot of the insect community that you're going to impact if you go for that nice, clean, total flat black burn, you just mow it all down like a golf course. You know, you're removing all the refuge for insects, you're removing all the cover for wildlife, so that's definitely a mistake I coach people into avoiding.
Great point. And a lot of the insects you're talking about, they're burrowing in to the hollow stems of a lot of these plants, correct?
They are.
You can't see them a lot of times. And so, like you said, you're just going in and mowing. You don't know necessarily what you're doing, but leaving half or more, or you know, somewhere around that 50% mark of a planting to maintain is super important.
What if somebody has a field that has a lot of natives already in it, but it had basically what would occur is they took a field that was a little rougher and tried to establish a cool season non-native pasture, and it didn't go so well, and so they have a mix of cool seasons, and then they also have natives trying to grow.
Well, there we're going from a reconstruction, because we were planting into something where there's no natives in the seed bank.
Yeah.
You basically can never recreate what a remnant prairie was.
Yes.
Now, if there's a remnant prairie component to that,
mm-hmm.
what I recommend people do is go ahead and avoid that spring and summer roundup.
Mm-hmm.
Fescue, which is predominantly what I find in that situation a lot of times, where people have overseeded a prairie thinking they're going to get this great cattle pasture.
Yeah.
You know, and all they do is wind up with the darn fescue with the endophyte in it and lose mm-hmm. weight on their cattle. They do a lot better going in November and December when most of the natives are dormant. And the one caveat with that is fescue can be a little tougher that time of year as far as taking up the herbicide. So I'll normally go in there in November, December, and I'll go into the little bit hotter, not a whole lot hotter, like a 3-4% solution of Roundup with the right adjuvants in there. Well water, city water, they're all pretty high pH. So I normally recommend that people buffer that down to a pH of around 4.5, so it gets better penetration into the epidermis of the plant, and using ammonium sulfate to acidify your water at least 17 pounds per 100 gallons of water with methylated seed oil as a sticker in there at 1 quart per 100 gallons. And get a good spray on that on one of those nice bluebird sunny days when it's 40, 50 degrees out, and you just knock that fescue back like nobody's business, because it's actually pulling carbohydrate down into the root system then, so it pulls all that in, and it's just phenomenal how that works. It actually works on the bush honeysuckle too. We've gone in on invasive control in woodlands with a helicopter and put down that same spray solution over the tree canopy. Mm-hmm. We did 1,200 acres that way and got an 80% kill out of it.
That's impressive.
That was very impressive.
Mm.
I think we're all hunters here, but that man right there gets some enjoyment out of killing some vegetation. Well, he goes, you do this, you do that, and you knock the snot out of it.
Yeah. Out of all the years, has there been one project where you've been like, that was the most rewarding, or that was the most fun to see that transformation? Is there any project or restoration that happened that really sticks in your mind?
Oh, the best reconstruction I've seen over time was actually on an old nuclear site, and we like to call it the St. Louis Pyramid, but it was the Weldon Springs Reclamation Site, and they had at first wanted to go in there and go cheap, and they had paid somebody to try to hydroseed fescue into it, and then they realized that they were going to be mowing, you know, 20, 25 weeks a year,
mm-hmm.
and went back to prairie, but that one actually went in with 40 species of forbs and 5 species of grasses into 150 acres. It was slow to come along, but now it you wouldn't hardly recognize it from a remnant, except for, you know, we know what we're looking at. Most remnants will have 300 species plus in there, and this is only 35 to 40 that actually succeeded in that. But that was a real gratifying one to do, because it was right next door to that honeysuckle, and it's also provided good income, because the landowner on the honeysuckle side doesn't control the Sericea, so it's good summer work.
Oh, that's funny.
Wow. Is there a, I'm thinking about prairies, do you have a favorite, like, native prairie in the country that you like to go to or that you've been to that's kind of special?
Oh, down in southwest Missouri, Golden Prairie is one of those. It's actually a national landmark now.
Yeah.
But it's one of the remnants owned by the Missouri Prairie Foundation. That's probably my favorite.
And where's that one at in southwest Missouri?
That's down by Lockwood.
Okay. Yeah.
Didn't we visit that? Yeah, we visited that.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
I'm close to Redneck.
Yeah. But
yeah, Redneck Blinds. Mm-hmm. We swung by. Anytime we're going along and we see signs and we have time, we're like, hey, it looks like there's a prairie over here. Let's go check it out. And I think that's when we checked that one out. So.
But Missouri Prairie Foundation has over 3,000 acres now of remnant prairie in the state that they've preserved. And that's any one of them's worth going to look at.
And you used to be president of Missouri Prairie Foundation, correct?
Yes.
And how many years were you doing that?
I was actually in a 4-year term. I only made it through 3 years because I had a heart attack on my 3rd year, so I had to
too many pass, bases pass were the involved torch. In his life that year.
I got the best of him my 3rd year.
Cerisa was really coming on strong.
Well, that was the year that we also acquired Pure Air Natives.
Okay.
And that was going into the native seed industry is not for the weak at heart.
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah, I sure have enjoyed talking to you. Is there any – I asked Justin, last time he was on the podcast, we the last 10 minutes we talked about our favorites. And I asked your son this in the booth this weekend. And do you have – what are your favorite – let's say, what's your favorite native grass? You weren't expecting that question.
Stumping him. He's been able to answer there's everything so many, but his
there's
favorite.
There's so many.
But. It's really tough to say, but actually my favorite native, and the only reason it is my favorite native is because I hate turf so bad, is that little Danthonia grass that grows in those cedar glades. It only gets about 2 inches tall, and I've always wanted to just, you know, being in the traditional horticulture industry for a little while just ruined me. I've just hated turf. You know, I got to the point where it's like, I don't see the point. You know, if you're going to cut grass, you might as well bale it up and feed it to something. It really has no functional use other than just to look at.
Yeah.
So that little grass has been one I've always dreamed of. That and buffalo grass are two of my favorites, because I've always wanted to, like, make the miniature prairie that you could put in your yard and never have to fire up the lawnmower.
There you go.
Man, that you know, Matt and I have talked about that a lot. Like, how frustrating is it for, once you start understanding natives and then non-natives and non-native invasives and understanding the effect to our footprint on the landscape, and then you go out and you fire up a lawnmower and you put ornamentals or you buy a house for like me, you buy a house that has all this landscaping done. My wife's like, oh man, the landscaping is beautiful, but none of it's native, and there's a Bradford pear in the front yard and it's all non-native grasses. It's like it almost gives me a heart attack thing, but it's like I can't even look around in my own yard. And I'm like, the dream for me would be to try to establish a yard that is native. And that's where I've looked at buffalo grass a lot. Some of these other natives that you're like, man, that could be really cool to establish and help people establish native landscapes and put in American beautyberry in your flower garden and some of these other big clumpy bunch grasses. But
well, basically, even with your trees, you know, there are like 300 insect species that use oaks.
Yeah.
You know, there are like 4 species that use Bradford pear.
Oh, no, yeah. Well, it's getting to be that time of year. Actually, my brother was driving over from where he lives in western Arkansas and said that he's already starting to see Bradford pears kind of down there, and it's a good time to start locating those and getting them killed off.
Yes, sir.
Yes. Sure is. Well, you turn around and you look at this banner back behind us, got the root system structure.
Oh, buffalo grass. I've looked at it so much. Seven foot and it looks like a
six inches on fescue. Yeah.
And not only that, but buffalo grass looks like it's 6 inches tall above ground, and then it's 6 foot below ground.
It's like the iceberg.
Yeah. Yeah. So, man, I'm trying to think if there's any other stories or
favorite
tips.
Forb.
Oh, yeah.
You talked about grass. What's your favorite forb?
Oh, I really enjoy seeing that first part of spring when the Indian paintbrush comes out. That's also a fascinating one because it'll just drive. We also do a greenhouse operation, and that will just drive you batty trying to grow it because it's a semi-parasitic species, and you have to grow it on with something else that it can parasitize. Otherwise, they'll germinate, they'll come up, they'll get a nice little plant going, and then they die.
So have you ever been? I'm sure you've been to Glatop Trail.
Yeah,
and we were there. We turkey hunted there last year, like one of the first or second week, and Indian paintbrush was everywhere. It's just beautiful. That's a place I would encourage everybody that's passing through southern Missouri to check out because it's a really cool place to see. So, Indian paintbrush. I don't think anybody's ever said that one.
I haven't
on this
heard
one.
That one.
Yeah, yours was Justin. You said what did you say?
I know it. Hold on. It's blue.
Let's see how much
aster.
You guys are paying.
Yeah,
it's something aster.
New England aster. Yeah, New England aster. That's right. Yeah, and I said like 10 because I can't ever narrow it down. So, yeah. Anyway, Justin, you got anything to add to John? You pretty much put the headset on and listen to him talk. So
yeah, you know, I get to do that regularly, and you know, that's always fun. Obviously, you know, he's been doing this a long time, so I shut up and listen and learn some stuff. So, and I know to paint a little picture for the listeners too, you guys were just about fighting over who gets to ask the next question over there. So you guys are pretty excited too to talk to John. So that was fun to see for me. But no, I just want to thank you guys for being with us this weekend and you know, coming and doing this seminar with us, and Nick and Jonathan and Debbie's here helping, and John Wingo, and you know, we've got a lot of experience and expertise in our booth this weekend, and really helped out a lot, and you guys being there to chat a little bit. You know, the hats, man. You guys got some good looking hats, man. I do need to throw in a quick little shout out to one of our employees back home who chose to go wine tasting instead of coming to the event with us. So, Brandon, I'll make sure I pick you up a hat before we come back. So, just know that we're all going to be teasing you for quite a while on that.
He won't live down the wine tasting ever. Nope. Public knowledge now.
But thanks for hanging out with us.
I got to ask one more question to John. He's so much around prairies the last 31 years. So what's the most – I know you got stories on it. You have a story, like interesting find in a story or in a prairie or basically any kind of old stories that revolve around the prairie. You got anything that comes up like on an establishment or stuff you've found in a prairie, like on some of the old prairie remnants, like a bird? How many bobolinks have you seen on prairies? Have you got to see many bobolinks?
Oh, they're on just about every MPF prairie. I like the scissor tail flycatcher.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Very cool.
And we haven't covered that one on one of our little profiles. That's definitely – I saw one the other day or back in the fall, and I'm like, we need to cover
that
one.
Sit there on that barbed wire and just
– scissor tail flycatcher. You know, I grew up in Mansfield, Missouri, which was mostly cattle pasture and timber and bad on both parts. And first time I ever saw a scissor tail flycatcher, I went to – my brother was playing baseball west of Springfield, Missouri, which is kind of in that area that Henry Schoolcraft talked about. You know, starting to see the tall prairies standing on the stirrups of a horse. And the first time I ever saw that flycatcher, scissor tail flycatcher, it was like, what is hanging off the back end of that bird? Just was like, that was something out of National Geographic. I'd never seen it. So that definitely is a cool one that I think a lot of people should check out. So anyway,
Matt? I think we're good.
Yeah, I don't appreciate what time
everyone.
Are we on?
I don't even know. Don't matter. I'm almost scared. We're rocking and rolling. So I appreciate everyone, Pure Air, and NWTF. Been a great weekend. Everyone coming out this evening too.
How can they talk to you guys when they're planting, starting to establish or think about planting this stuff? How do they get in touch?
They can get in touch with us through the email address sales@pureairnatives.com or give us a call 636-357-6433.
Perfect.
There you have it. I have no idea how to memorize that. When he rattled that off, it sounded like way more numbers than a phone number. But whatever. Maybe it'll work for him. Anyway, guys, hopefully you enjoyed it. We'll catch you next time.
See ya.